Hello, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Swan, Swine, and Swindlers, coping with the growing threat of mega crises with Ian Mitroff. So I would like to just tell you very briefly, Ian has a PhD in engineering and philosophy of science from UC Berkeley. He is now an adjunct professor at UC Berkeley. He's the author of 29 books, and he is the president of Mitroff Crisis Management. And now I'd just like to get right into Ian. So please welcome him. Ian, I'm sorry.
Thank you all for coming. Let me say, first of all, I am for profit, and I'm highly partisan. So I do send you greetings tonight from that guy in Washington who's also talking about crises, and he gives you his dispensation to be here. There will be an exam after. You can take the exam either on the State of the Union speech or on what I'm going to talk about. That is the end of my feeble attempts at humor, because what I have to talk about tonight is a very serious subject. And so let me begin. My major themes tonight are crises and messes. But what I'm going to talk about is how they've just exploded, and they're not just ordinary crises and messes that we're faced with. And later on, I'm going to give you a technical definition of a mess beyond the ordinary, everyday notion that we all carry with us. And I'm going to talk about mega crises, because they're no longer compact, they're no longer isolated, they're no longer small, unfortunately. And the question is, of course, you know, what do we do? How do we cope with them? And in this world, with messes, you cope. You don't, quote, solve them. First of all, I want to start by giving you a definition of a crisis, lay the ground rules here. Let me take you first through the common definition, because I'm going to depart from that. It's not that the common definition is wrong. It's just incomplete. It doesn't cover everything what a crisis does. So the common definition, a crisis is an unpredictable, likely event with severe consequences. A potential to destroy an individual, an organization, affect whole societies, and now the entire globe. And they cause incredible harm, injuries, damage, severe financial losses and hardship, unfavorable publicity that just comes along with the territory, destroy an individual organization, which I said, and they do have that potential. And we'll talk more about that. But what I want to give to you is a definition that I've worked on for years, because I've observed what crises do. And they do more than this cognitive definition. They're intensely personal. So I want to give you an existential, philosophical definition. A crisis, and the reason why it's a crisis and so traumatic, it destroys all of our background, taken for granted, assumptions, unconscious sacred assumptions that we're making about the goodness, trustworthiness of our fellow citizens, the institution, society, and the whole world. And I'll give you an example in a second. So the most basic assumptions that give meaning to, that shore up our existence, or the proverbial rug, is just pulled out from under us. And that's why the crises are traumatic. And it threatens our basic existence. And I'll give you an example. Fort Hood. Some of you may remember a couple of years ago, an Army psychiatrist went on a shooting rampage, and he shot, you know, his fellow soldiers. Now, here were the assumptions that were perturbed, because when I look at crises, not only look at the surface events, but I dig beneath the surface. For, I've been in this studying crises for about 30 years. And by the way, I couldn't really do it without either an engineering and or a philosophy background to look at basic assumptions. So the first assumption, it was one of us, one of our own, not the enemy over there. Second one, it happened here, not in a, you know, in a, some foreign land, so it was brought home to us. And the third, somebody from the helping profession. There were other assumptions as well. But the point is that a crisis is a crisis, because it demolishes in one fell swoop all of the assumptions. Most of the time, we're unconscious, we're unaware of that. One of the ones that I've used historically to talk about this is Oklahoma City. Remember when Timothy McVeigh, you know, quote, American terrorist, blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. And let me go just quickly what the assumptions were, because, you know, they're all in the background. You don't necessarily see them. It just, they don't, the news media don't necessarily talk about it. You have to extract them. So the first one was terrorism doesn't happen in the heartland of America. It happens in the Middle East or in Europe. Second one is that an American won't kill other Americans in that way, so demolish those two. And the third one, which was the most heinous of all, is that innocent men, women, and children won't be killed. And we, let's see if we can get back into the slides here. Okay. So every crisis, I could talk for hours because it's literally crisis du jour, unfortunately, just whatever is happening. So Penn State, I'll say a little bit about that. UC Davis, Syracuse, British Petroleum, BP, Wall Street, our friend Rupert Murdoch, and it goes on and on. But let me say, I want to give you some background about Penn State and what happened and what were some of the things that I believe were going on in the background beneath the surface. I was at USC for 26 years. And towards the latter part of my time there, along with one of the vice provosts at USC, I was the co-chair of the Crisis Committee for USC. And what we try to do is obviously prepare USC so whatever crisis it ran into, it would handle it better than the ordinary organization. So one of the things we did in order to get background, coming from the provost's office, we sent out a survey to America's colleges and universities. And because it came from the provost's office, we got a fantastic rate of return. Most of the time you send out a survey, if you get 10, 20% rate of return, you're doing great. In this case, I don't know, we got 40, 50%. It was incredible. And here's what we found is that how do colleges and universities fare relative to corporations? Because most of my career I work with corporations, not-for-profits, and studying, you know, how they handle crisis, in many cases mishandle it. And it turns out, relative to corporations, as bad as they can be, colleges and universities even worse. And part of it is the siloing of universities. If, you know, we think GM is bad with all of its different car divisions that don't talk to one another. Well, universities, you know, just leave me alone. I want to do my research. I'm attached to a department. So you have to think about the whole of the institution if you're going to really... You're going to have quality products or quality service, and you're going to have a good crisis plan, but they don't do that. Well, they were well prepared for a certain range of crises, and which crises were they well prepared? And which crises they were prepared for versus not sheds light in Penn State, UC Davis, and Syracuse. Okay, relatively well prepared for fires, relatively well prepared for explosions, lawsuits, crimes, environmental mishaps. Now, with certain exceptions, these are impersonal crises, obviously not lawsuits, but in complete isolation. So they were somewhat prepared. They had plans for them, but they were compared in isolation. And the defect of that is I've never seen a crisis that is ever a single crisis. It may start here and it sets off there and it just snowballs, becomes an uncontrolled chain reaction. So if you prepare crisis plans in isolation, you're somewhat better, but in a way you're worse off because you think you're prepared when you really aren't. So it's false preparedness. You know, just the example, I could draw an arrow between any one of these and they would circle back and forth. So the best organizations don't prepare crisis plan in isolation. They think systemically, well, if this one happens, what happens? It sets our, because any one of these can be cause and effect. The initial crisis could start in one of these boxes, but if there's a mishap or there's mispreparation or a weakness in any one of the boxes, it will soon lead to that. Poorly prepared for athletic crises. Uh-huh. Poorly prepared, you know, whether it's sex, drinking parties, you know, get kids to play football, Colorado State. Ethical breaches, not as well prepared. Damage to reputation. Sabotage and terrorism, and until relatively recently, we had to have a number of shootings at Virginia Tech and other places until that got on the radar screen. Okay, let's take UC Davis. And this is one of the things that most organizations never think about. This is the actual photograph, obviously, of the officer going up and down the line with a pepper spray. Not prepared for that. The horrific images of that would spread around the world. But certainly not prepared for that. And that's just one of the pictures off the internet. My good friend Richard Menon is in the audience. We've known one another for years. He's a professor of drama. And we spent a lot of time this weekend talking about one of the things that is least treated in crises, except, of course, in literature and drama, is the dramatic aspects of crises. And that is just one of the images that you can just pull off the internet. And you think that all these brilliant cognitive geniuses in universities would think about that? No, of course not. And one of the reasons, you know, going through philosophy, you know, of course you learn epistemology, you learn ethics. But one of the things that is least developed, you know, of all institutions is the aesthetics of knowledge. And if this doesn't hit both the aesthetics, good and bad, you know, then I don't know what it does. Because the Concordia, the images are overwhelming. And by the way, the images are played and played again until they wear off. That's one of the primary things about crises, until the next one comes along, you know, and then it's short. The images are horrific, and they are. And apparently it's purported, I don't know whether it will, but it'll cost $90 million. I can imagine how much Carnival paid spent on crisis management. I don't know, in training. But I do know that in Toyota, for example, if they had spent for them a measly $1 million, and the reason why the $1 million figure is on my mind, because they were reputed in responding to their crisis, remember where the accelerator pedal sticking and, you know, a couple of people were killed, that they were spending $1 million an hour to upgrade their technology. They only spent $1 million a year on a high-grade, you know, maybe crisis team. They could handle the crisis better. And the $1 million is only 0.05% of the billions that reputed to cost Toyota. So the point is, crisis management is just, the money you spend is just a drop in the bucket compared to the cost of a crisis. One of the things that happens in every crisis is that sick jokes are one of the ways that people get their tension and anxiety out. So I don't know whether you remember, NASA became, you know, need another 7 astronauts. And you can play around with Penn State. You can come up with your own, because I know that will happen. I'm certainly not condoning it, but I know how the human psyche works. Big part of my background is in psychology and a lifelong student of psychoanalysis. The legacy, poor legacy, you know, we all know that, should know that Joe Paterno passed away this weekend, and I really do feel sorry for him, a man who was thrust into this kind of undeserved limelight, you know, not a clue how to handle a crisis, that, or he thought he was, and the organization didn't follow him up. Let's get back to the crises that universities and colleges are prepared for. Partly is it explained by frequency. Partly what they were prepared for is explained by, yeah, these are pretty frequent. But that's not the whole of it, because when we also did interviews and when we followed up our surveys, not a single university officer even mentioned the possibility of child abuse occurring on the campus, even though they all had a major child care facility. I mean, when I was at USC, if you go through the businesses that a major university, and by the way, USC is now one of the major employers in LA, it's even, you know, thinking in the aircraft and the movie business. They all, USC is in the healthcare business, in the mortuary business, in the insurance business, in the entertainment business. Oh, yeah, and it's also in the education business. But these other businesses almost dwarf, you know, the main business. The major concern with the provost of the university about child care, they had a child care facility here, and maybe right next door was some lab that had some bad stuff growing, you know, and if this thing exploded, it would, you know, obviously endanger the children. But not a single one mentioned, well, what if child abuse would happen, what that would do to our campus. It was very clear that we were strictly forbidden when we did our surveys of crisis management and followed up, that we were strictly prevented from interviewing anyone connected with the athletic department, even though we, you know, I mean, USC was put on probation, that Reggie Bush, Heisman Trophy winner, had to give back the Heisman Trophy, you know, for under the table money, that in the way his family was taken care of. Head of athletics was the least likely member if the campus had a crisis management team. He was not, you know, I have a very good friend whose name I cannot mention. I can't mention where he is. This man was interviewed and offered the job at a major university. One of the universities that's a major football factory. And he turned it down because the conditions for getting the job is that the fraternities were off limit and the athletic department was off limit. Don't touch him. He said, sorry, you know, I'm not your man, because he knew what a barrel of fun he would be inheriting. So the message was loud and clear. Athletics is a very big business, not just, you know, the games and selling the tickets, but all the paraphernalia, the retail stores, you know, TV and all the rest of that. So forget it. No way. Don't mess with it. Don't you dare mess with it. Don't you mess with it. Football pays, you know, for just the whole athletic program, pretty much all of it. When we also dug deeper, we gave universities, you know, here's a list of programs and tell me what support. Obviously, undergraduate education and graduate education had high support. Dealing with the board had high support. But the lowest had the least support of almost any of the program, maybe just before, just only building maintenance was lower than that, was crisis management. And to put it mildly, the time is way overdue to give crisis management the importance it deserves. In fact, for me, it's a key prerequisite for leadership. No one ought to be ahead of any organization, any major organization, without a clear grounding. And in fact, there are some organizations who do take it seriously, have a chief crisis officer. And we're getting close to the point where somebody who spent their time in that will maybe ascend to become CEO of the organization. The thing I want to move on now is talk a little bit more about crises. All crises, I said earlier, are part of a chain reaction. A single crisis never happens in isolation. So a crisis that happens here is very likely to set up a crisis over here. So again, if you're only prepared for one, you're not prepared. One of the prime purposes of crisis management is to get out in front of the chain. And so an institution is not destroyed by an never-ending firestorm of out-of-control crises. Or drip, 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 you know, whatever institution happens to. And it's more than just the domino. I mean, that's a simplified diagram. The dominoes ought to be going every which way. It's like multiple dominoes are occurring in an organization. For example, when I was at USC and we did a crisis audit of USC, and we looked at the retail outlets, looked at the insurance and the hotel complex for the students, one of the things we were very quickly able to identify were all the ticking time bombs. In fact, that was a good way to present it to the president and say, you've got all these separate complex parts of the business. It's a multi-billion dollar a year organization. Look at all, and no one had ever connected the dots. And that's one of the chief pitfalls if you don't do that while you get into a crisis. You can't just react. It makes things worse. It makes the chain reaction become uncontrolled. And BP is the poster child. If you think you can just react so you lose how many, you know, 90 days, you know, where the oil is gushing out in the sea with the environmental mishap. So if you're not prepared, you don't have the damage containment mechanisms, not only, and they're not just tested and tried, but continually updated because it's a moving target, then you're not prepared. I mean, one of the standards I use is, when do you stop painting the Golden Gate Bridge? Never, because we never have complete rust-proof paints and steel, so you're always repainting the bridge. You always want to make it better. What happened in Japan, the nuclear accident? Okay, so you designed it for whatever, a 6.0 earthquake. Every year would be an upgrading, you know, that you would improve it so you, to the extent that you can, so it would stand larger and larger earthquakes. It's no longer a question in the business that I do in crisis management. It's no longer an if, but it's only a how, when, where, why, and who's responsible for the latest crisis. So even with crisis preparation, the best of it, crises will still happen. The world is too complex. But here's the rub, or here's the important thing. Years ago, we're ready to send out another round of the survey. Prior to 9/11, I was working with a graduate student, And we made up a survey just prior to 9/11 and sent it out to the Fortune 500 companies. We gave them a big laundry list of crises and asked which things are you prepared for, which things are you not prepared for. And at that time, right prior to 9/11, terror preparation for terrorism among corporations was essentially zilch. And then 9/11 happened and said, oh my God, let's send it back out and see if anything happened. Sure enough, preparation for terrorism went to the top of the list. And then I said, let's send it out 1 year and 2 years later. And lo and behold, 2 years after 9/11, the preparation or attention for terrorism was back to where it was pre-9/11. Now, if 9/11 isn't a big enough kick in the head, well, it isn't, because you have to be psychologically prepared, mature, in order to face these god-awful threatening events. It's not just enough to be hit by it. That, you know, unfortunately, that's not the way people learn. It's just like saying, you know, I'm not a medical doctor. I couldn't go in and do surgery. You know, I'd faint at the sight of blood. Well, you can't do it untrained, so you have to be prepared for this to be able to handle the enormous anxiety that crises raise. So failure to learn from others. For example, can you imagine my having gone into Penn State and saying, hey, guys, you ought to learn from the Catholic Church. Oh, yeah, we're not the church. Yeah, right. And so I have a perverse law here. Here's my Mitrov's law. The time that a previous institution has mishandled its crisis or failed to address it, it's inversely proportional to the time that you will be allotted when finally people get fed up and say, well, now all the chickens are going to come home. You know, okay, they didn't handle their cases of child abuse that it cost the billions. Well, you're not going to get off the hook because finally, you know, people do wake up. And okay, what's good crisis management? This is a little bit of talk. Well, plan, think systemically. That's what good crisis. So you don't prepare for crises in isolation. You pick up early warning signals. All crises pretty much sent out a trail of early warning signals. Now, this is interesting with Costa Concordia. Were there signals before on the nature of the captain there that, you know, I mean, one of the unthinkables that he abandoned ship. You know, the captain's supposed to stay there, be the last one off. There had to be some signals. There had to be always somebody in the bowels of the ship, the bowels of the organization that says something's not right here. And now we know with all the noise in organizations, it's hard to pick up signals. But I don't buy that, because organizations are set up day to day to pick up the most minute signals that threaten their sales and their marketing and figures, because it's a dedicated function. Well, it makes sense. Of course it does. Well, the ante's been up, folks. You now have to pick up all kinds of other data and signals. You have to have damage containment mechanisms, and then I can go into that in great detail, but that's not what I want to leave you with tonight. Have to have a crisis management team. And the crisis management team ought to have all the senior officers of the organization. And they ought to meet periodically, at least once a month, whether there's been a major crisis or not, to say, smell anything going on. And the good organizations that do this, because that also came out of our surveys, the organizations that practice good crisis management are more profitable, because the stuff they do in crisis management, picking up signals and all the rest of that, helps them make better products. It helps them pick up problems in the quality control of product. So I've learned you can't sell crisis management just for itself. Organizations don't have that money and the time. So if you want to sell crisis management to an organization, to all organizations, it's got to be coupled to a program that they're already taking seriously, and it's really integral to the organization. Otherwise, it won't get done. It makes sense, so it's got to be integrated. If I had to pick one factor, though, one factor above all that's the whole game, the whole enchilada, would be Freudian defense mechanisms. If Freud had discovered nothing other then defense mechanisms, that would have been enough, at least in my mind, to ensure his everlasting fame. And what Freud discovered is that the child, the early ego, has to be protected. It's so fragile that there are defense mechanisms, because it would just be overwhelmed by the buzzing, blooming confusion of reality. And so what Freud discovered were the defense mechanisms that protected the ego. So if you come downstairs one day and there's a saber-toothed tiger down there, you know, the mind shuts down. It can shut down. It refuses to see it, because if you see it, it's life and death. It happens in the battlefield. Soldiers come back from Iraq or whatever it is, and they're, you know, the mind literally shuts down as a protective device. So denial, out-and-out denial that the event is even there, because if it's there, you have to do something about it. Can't do anything about it, then it's trauma. The second mechanism is disavowal. So I take the threat, and I take the saber-toothed tiger, the tiger, and reduce it down to a small threat. So disavowal recognizes the event or the threat, but it shrinks it down to something manageable. Okay, and that's one of the mechanisms that Freud discovered. Idealization. Hey, I'm Superman, Superwoman. You know, I'm ideal. I live an ideal life. Can't be anything like that invading my life, or we're an ideal family, whatever it is. Grandiosity. I'm so big and strong that I can take on anything. Projection. That damn saber-toothed tiger is in the room because of that bad guy there at the back of the room. So, you know, I blame it on somebody else. And this gets me into one of the other great psychoanalysts of all time, Melanie Klein. Melanie Klein lived in the 1920s, 40s in London, and she was a child, a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. She literally invented play therapy. And one of the earliest mechanisms that Melanie Klein discovered that's early in children is splitting. And splitting is as follows. The mind of the young child is undeveloped such that can't really accept that the good mommy and good daddy that meet its needs is the same as the bad mommy, bad daddy that have to discipline the child, say, no, you got to go in your room, you can't do this. And it takes maybe up to four or five when they both those images come together and say, okay, accept that it's the same person. And splitting obviously can last for life, and it's made use of by politicians all the time. You know, good guys, bad guys, and fear mongering, and all the rest of it. So these things aren't just something that just end in childhood. They can, particularly if there's trauma, then they can carry on for life. Intellectualization. Well, let's see. Well, the tiger is there. I'm going to build a computer model of it, and it's going to stay put, you know, the most effective way. Yeah, okay. That happens a lot in organization. A cognitive approach, unrecognizing or not attending to the intense emotions that accompany, and compartmentalization. Part of me hears the threat. Part of me sees it. But the mind doesn't bring together the ear and the eye, because, again, if I did, I'd have to see the full whole threat. Now, here's the point about the organization. It's maybe scary enough to hear the Freudian defense mechanisms for a single person. But when you go around to an organization like I have, and you interview 20 to 30 of the top executives, and you hear them all utter the same rationalizations, then you're into a culture of denial. That it's shared, because we know there's groupthink, and they're contagious, and we become part of the organization. You got to buy into the myths, you got to buy into the groupthink. So invulnerability is the counterform of denial. Hey, we're invulnerable. Nothing bad can happen to us. Well, you may think you're invulnerable like Exxon Valdez or BP, but it's certainly not true. The impacts are negligible. Probabilities are small. Anything bad would happen. We don't have problems. Counterpart to idealization. Excellent organizations don't have problems. Oh, yeah, really? Why do you think people want to go out and attack Johnson & Johnson? Because then they'll make a really big statement against a major organization. So you may think you don't have problems. That's a red flag. We're big and powerful. Exxon, BP. Okay, we can handle anything. Someone else is to blame. That's projection. The probabilities of anything bad happening are small of a major crisis. And can't affect the whole system. You'll just be confined. Baloney. Now, they all make sense. You know, when Ian goes around, you know, I've been around enough that I've heard primitive versus advanced denial. Primitive denial is so, you know, transparent you can see through it. Advanced denial, it makes sense. Okay, you know, there's an element of truth, but I just don't buy it. You know, I don't buy any of these anymore. Let me tell you about a study that one of my graduate students did, which shows the power of defense denial mechanism. It was a great study. It was this woman's dissertation. So she did 125 interviews in seven chemical companies. And what we were able to do in the graph here, we were able to plot their crisis management performance, how well they were prepared for crises, versus the number of denial mechanisms that they used. And lo and behold, look at proactive react. Proactive companies are companies that are prepared for more crises than they've experienced. Proactive, reactive, experience more than they're prepared for. Does that make sense? Any questions? You know, let me give you the mindset. Let me tell you in plain English what this stuff means. Otherwise, it's gobbledygook. The proactive companies that were relatively well-prepared acted as though they were unprepared. And the reactive companies that were poorly prepared acted as though they were well-prepared. That's it, folks. That's corporate culture. I mean, it's more complex than that, obviously. But that tells you the ends of the spectrum. Okay? And we had the data from this other study that the proactive companies were significantly more profitable, experienced fewer crises. They experienced crises, too, but substantially fewer, where the reactive companies were substantially less profitable, lived to be longer, had significantly more crises. So, and the proactive companies, if they had a crisis, recovered faster, quicker, because it was in the culture and they practiced this kind of stuff. Part of what we're dealing with is overly rigid, bureaucratic, authoritarian organization. They run the gamut from universities to corporate. They prize secrecy and control, Catholic Church, whatever it is. Impossible for anybody beneath the top to take appropriate timely action. These things don't happen at random. I don't believe that. Protect those at the top from knowing really what's going on the bottom. That's what a lot of the organizations are about. They're really protective devices. And they really exist to protect those at the top. The top really doesn't want to know in many cases. If it knew, it'd have to take action. It's not just that ignorance is bliss, but here's the kicker. Ignorance wards off the enormous anxieties that are a fundamental part of having to deal with complex, messy situations that by definition do not have easy, simple solutions. That's one of the things that's really going on. And T.S. Eliot, great British poet, who I understand was American, I think said it best of all, humankind cannot bear much reality. Humankind cannot bear much reality, and yet we live in a world, that's part of the problem or issue. Some people find it exhilarating, interesting. I do, because it is so complex. So crises and their effects are increasing exponentially. They're larger, they're deadlier, they're costlier, and they come at us faster and faster, so the time between them shrinks precipitously, such that we're deep in the age of super crises. We're not dealing with piddly crises anymore. At least three major causes. Now here I'm going to get back to the title of the book, Swans. Swans are crises that are caused by false assumptions and mistaken beliefs. And it really, Swans comes from the work of the best-selling author, The Black Swan, by Nicholas Taleb. And so people discount highly improbable events, making them think they're even more improbable than they really are, and it turned out they're not improbable, that have extremely large impacts. One of the reasons why I am an opponent of risk management. Risk management is a mathematical procedure. It comes from probability theory. That what you do, you take the probability event, multiply its consequence, and then you get a kind of an expected value. So like if every time, say, the number one comes up on a die, you get $10, you know, then, but it only comes, the probability is 1/6, so 1/6 times $10 or whatever, that's the expected amount that you would expect to get on, and now you'd have to add up what all the expected values are. The reason why that breaks down, 9/11 was very improbable, but high consequence. So when you do crisis management, you say, let the probabilities go, friends, because I know what's going to happen. You're going to neglect. Low probability, high consequence events are going to come back to haunt you. Because there's always, when I do risk management with people, I say, we're getting to four groups. One group where, say it's a tornado, I don't care what it is. You're going to look at what makes it a low probability versus high probability in this city. And you're going to look at what can make it high consequence and low consequence. So unless I know the assumptions that are going on in those cells, I'm not going to buy a single number. I learned that much from engineering. Unless I know how the number was arrived at, never trust the single number, which is what risk management tends to give you. I'm highly distrustful of it. And so here's the black swan. Wall Street not only failed to design, manage a financial system that was resilient to black swans, but it fostered a culture that systematically ignored and hence made them more probable. So just the reverse. Swine, the second word in the title, are, well, we greed, hubris, arrogance. And BP more than fits the boat here. Drilling the deepest oil well gas in history and thinking you're well prepared and all the rest. If that reflects effective operations and planning, God help us. Particularly since a few years ago in one of BP's other facilities, it had a tremendous fire in Texas City. And it really failed to learn the lessons. I'm a member of a research center at Berkeley called Center for Catastrophic Risk Management. And we have people in there who study high reliability organizations. And supposedly BP wanted to be a high reliability organization, wrote out a manual and all the rest of that. But it didn't internalize it, didn't take it seriously. I come out of the philosophical school. In fact, my mentor is pragmatism. The man who taught me is Wes Churchman, who was at Berkeley, and his teacher was a man by E.A. Singer. And in my office at home, I have a photostatic copy of an 1896 letter from William James to the provost of Penn recommending Singer for a job, saying in his 30 years of giving philosophy, Singer was one of the best students he had. So intellectually, William James is my great-grandfather. But here's pragmatism's definition of truth. Truth is that which makes an ethical difference in the quality of your lives. Now, we can debate what's ethics and different theories, but the point is, in pragmatism, truth and ethics are not separable. But that little word makes, it says you ain't got truth until you've actually implemented something, hopefully ethically. So if you just have an article that appears in, you know, some journal or anything, that's a certain kind of truth, maybe propositional. But it's not pragmatism's definition of truth. And by that definition, I'd have to say that I, too, break down and fail because I'd like to see, you know, crisis management be implemented more, taken more seriously. But the point is, it's a severe scorecard, and I abide by it because I believe in pragmatism's definition of truth. A gross failure learned from previous crises. Swindlers. Well, we got Bernie. We got Bernie here. That's the other part of the title. I wish, by the way, at the title I had come up with it. One of my graduate students came up with it. I thought it was a great title. So, Swan, Swine, and Swindlers. particularly long before they occurred, these really send out early warning signals. So the Security Exchange Commission didn't do a good job in picking up the signals. I want to say a little bit, in the 16th, 17th century, the political philosopher Thomas Malthus talked about the Malthus effect, namely that he saw that population was increasing exponentially, but food was only increasing linear. Therefore, the inevitable fate of humankind was starvation. He couldn't anticipate, you know, we would get better in food technology. But if he were alive today, he'd be pretty good on crisis management, because to think systemically and because the crises are outstripped are poor preparation and crisis planning. And it requires really high levels of emotional intelligence, even higher levels of emotional, moral, and spiritual intelligence. So let me talk about Tony Hayward. Picking on poor Tony. He deserves it. Tony Hayward, the post CEO of BP. Tony got his PhD in geological engineering at the ripe old age of 22. So cognitively speaking, he's a genius. But Ian will say emotionally he's a midget. You know, I want to get my life back when what's happening to the Gulf, you know. We need people, obviously, with high levels of both. Okay, let me just say a little bit very quickly about messes, because I see my time is closing in here, and I want to have plenty of time for questions. All crises are messes, but not all messes are crises. I want to say a little bit about messes, and here's what a mess is. And that's due also to one of my mentors, Russ Acuff, who taught at Penn for years. He taught, he had a program, Social System Science. And here's it's my paraphrasing of Russ. A mess is a complex system of problems where the problems are so tightly bound together that the problems are not only inseparable, but you can't take any problem out of the mess without either sorting the problem or the entire mess itself, the system of which they are part. Okay, so this is Acuff. This is Acuff's quote. It's long, I know, but Acuff was really good, a genius. So people are not, you know, Acuff, managers don't solve problems, they manage messes. And that's true of most people. That's what they do. They don't solve individual, you know, and problems are abstracted from messes. And Acuff, that's his, the bottom line. A partial solution to a whole system of problems is better than a whole solution to each of its parts taken separately. And I've spent a large time of my career working on the type 3 error, solving the wrong problem precisely. Don't solve the wrong problem precisely. In order to know whether you're solving the right or wrong problem, you've got to look at the entire mess and say, what am I focusing on? Better the wrong solution or the right problem, the right solution, wrong problem. The wrong solution, right problem, okay, maybe I'll learn from my errors. But if I go down the wrong track, the wrong tunnel, I'll never get back up to the top and correct myself. None of the problems that are part of mess can be taken apart and analyzed independently. You've got to look at interactions. A system is the product of its interactions. It's not the sum of its separate solutions. So in a system, if I do well in one part and get a score of 100 and do lousy in another part and get a 0, 100 times 0 is 0. That's what the measure of performance is in a system. The education mess, if I had more time, I'm working on my latest book, my 30th book, with the state superintendent of education in Indiana and dean of education, and working on the education mess, one of the preeminent messes that we're facing. And it turns out all messes are a part of one. The education mess, not separate from the financial mess, the housing mess, blah, blah, blah. And they're all interconnected, so that's just some of the education mess. So you can't take bullying out of set. You can study bullying, but you've got to study the interactions. Okay, I'm gonna end with this, and I wanna show this graph here, and then I'm gonna stop and leave time for questions. this graph or this picture appeared on the front page of the New York Times Tuesday 2010, about a year and a half ago. And what it was, here's the byline. The junior officers in Afghanistan prepared a PowerPoint for the senior officers trying to show them all the forces that were involved in fighting successfully, hopefully winning the Afghan war. Okay? And the senior officer, here's a blow up a part of it, they looked at that and they gorked out. And General Stanley McChrystal, head of the American NATO force, he summed it up contemptuously. When we understand this diagram, we'll win the war. Well, he was right for the wrong reasons. Because 16 months later, he said we didn't have enough information to fight the war. So it's like blaming the instrument, literally, for showing us the craters on the moon. But here's the point. Most of us, including myself, we've not been educated, not rewarded, not weaned on how to deal with messes. And lo and behold, now we're in the world where we're hit with these messes on every front. Everything is a mess, not a simple problem. Systems of incredible complexity, and yet none of our basic systems have prepared, allowed, rewarded. So the consequence, the enormous gap, grows daily between the size of a problem and the narrowness of our thinking. Miseducation, I'm going to go over this. Feed students. This is not a word problem, it's a word exercise. An exercise is a wrong way to teach kids because everything is given. And where a real problem, the big part of a problem is to formulate the problem. So problems are, exercises are well defined, but problems aren't. There are as many different definitions of problem as there are different stakeholders. Okay, I'm going to go by here because. Okay, let me talk about this, what Acuff talked about. Most of us people are also not trained how to dispose of problems. There are at least four different ways or different senses of the verb to solve. Absolve, do nothing, hope the problem goes away on its own, not the stuff we're faced with. Dissolve, which is what Mrs. call redesign some of the underlying conditions in the system. Hopefully that will get rid of or help tame the problem. That's a whole other thing. They're tame versus wicked problems. Tame problems are problems that can be formulated and handled by any scientific discipline or profession. Wicked problems go beyond any known discipline. And all messes have more than their modicum of wickedness. In fact, one of the ways to differentiate messes is in their degree of wickedness. Resolve, you accept less than an optimal solution and solve optimal. That's only true for exercises that you can solve. You educate people on that. They get frustrated if they can't, quote, solve these problems in, you know, in a few lines or whatever it is. That's what messes ideally. Okay, I'm going to stop with this, that in the book beyond the one I'm talking about tonight, I tried to come up with as many heuristics for how to handle messes. And for years I dealt with the Myers-Briggs, but I use it as a problem-solving technique. And one of the things is every problem has aspects that fall in these four quadrants, which come out of the Myers-Briggs. So you can look at a detailed, narrow, technical definitional problem. You look at the system. You can look at a community, and you look at intensely personal affects. In fact, that's applying it to the healthcare mess. I know that's going by very fast. Some of you are interested. We can talk a bit more about it. Okay, let me stop here. And this last slide is also how somebody handled a mess. It's by an artist, Mark Lombardi. Mark Lombardi was accounted the dubious distinction of right after 9/11, a couple of FBI agents came into a gallery where he was displaying his work, and they looked at it because he was part art historian, part investigative reporter, part graphic artist. And what this whole diagram is about, he traced out the nefarious financial relations between the Bin Laden and the Bush family. So you often take people who are smart who come outside of a discipline to look at what the people inside of a discipline don't look at. And then finally, I'm going to leave you with this. I've worked with a graphic designer over the past year, not to trivialize crisis management, to make a board game. So when I go out and do workshops, can maybe get people into all the things they need to do to be prepared, and not to make it, quote, fun, but really make the lessons hopefully come to light with a different aesthetic and all the different ways hopefully you can reach people. Okay, let me stop here. We do have time for questions, and I really do welcome whatever questions you have.
Okay, thank you. We're going to do questions with the microphone because this is being recorded for radio and play on the podcast. Our program tonight is Ian Mitroff, Swines, Swans, and Swindlers, Mega Messes and Mega Crises. And my name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. We are going to turn it over to the audience now. I will bring the mic over. If you have a question, please do speak it into the mic. And we'll have about 15 minutes for questions and answers.
Yes, sir. Say your name, please.
My name is Jim Brown. Professor Mitroff, you gave several excellent examples of companies that didn't manage crises correctly.
Right.
Can you give us a few examples of what you would say companies that have had major crises and responded well and successfully?
Well, the first one that, you know, really set off the field of modern crisis management is Johnson & Johnson with the Tylenol crisis. Up to that time, there wasn't a field of crisis management, so they just reacted. Nonetheless, they have learned up to a point, because doing well at one point doesn't guarantee you're going to do well later. So later, when they had a subsequent crisis, namely if you take Tylenol and drink red wine, it's not good for your liver. They didn't do so well. So there are organizations, but to keep it alive in the culture and continue learning is very, very hard. I often, for good reason, don't mention any good examples because, you know, it's like waving a red flag. And they're constantly shifting. But there are, you know, when we do our surveys, we do find, I can mention a number of them I don't want. I mean, and by the way, what I would say, they're scattered throughout all industries. It's not like this one particular industry, you know, has all the good guys. No, you find them scattered throughout every industry. And it's amazing how, first of all, people don't even learn from other good members in the industry, let alone that they would learn lessons from people outside the industry. When I was at USC and I had a Center for Crisis Management, we put on seminars and we invited people from different industries so they could share lessons. And a few people did get in. They didn't say, oh, well, we're not in that industry, therefore there's nothing we can learn. Let me tell you one thing that I won't name the company. Years ago, I was on the road. And this was a pharmaceutical company. So I went in and I said, hey, what are you guys learning about product tampering? And the guy said, well, we had an internal assassin team. He said, you have what? He said, yeah, nobody knows as much about our products as we do. So one day we held up one of our bottles and we said, well, let's look at the cap as the front door of a house and the walls as a wall. How could the burglar get in and do the most damage? And we had two teams, one with a high school education, one with a PhD. And we went back and forth. Can't keep people out completely. No such thing as perfect seals. Forget that, you know. But we learned about tamper evidence seals and all the rest of that. So it's a continuing game, okay? And I've used the internal assassin team exercise with a few of my clients to say, okay, let's come through and let's think about creatively, because you guys can be creative if you want to, how you're going to attack your organization and do real damage. Okay, I give you a long response. Anybody else? Let me. Yes, ma'am.
Well, first of all, I'll pass the microphone around. My question is in regard to your slide on denial, disavowal, and then the other column of organization. Condoleezza Rice and Bush knew a month or two in advance of 9/11 that there was going to be some airplanes hitting some tall buildings in America. One of the best statements I heard regarding that and their knowledge was Condoleezza at one point said, we knew it was going to happen. We didn't know where. We didn't know when. Did you want us to shut down all airlines in America? Which was a very good response. And bringing it closer to home with an earthquake, God forbid, we have here. We're expecting a big one. If you live in a tall building that was built to a size 6 magnitude earthquake, and it's going to be a 7, are we supposed to die of stress worrying about these things in advance?
Well, no, see, it goes back to what I said, that unless one is really psychologically prepared, you really can't think about it. We shut down. Because between, you know, going in a closet and worrying, you know, and experiencing trauma and sitting down and thinking about all the things, there's a lot of room. And I work with the organization, but you can't do the first thing out of the box, and it happens to all of us, you know, that it happens to me as well, that you say, no, wait a second, let's try and work back and think about, let's not pretend that all the anxiety is going to go out forever. That's not humanly possible. But all things involve anxiety. But let's see if we can manage the anxiety, which is a big part. Let's see if I can come all the way back here. Maybe I can't. Yeah, maybe it's too far back. I think we'll get there pretty soon. But anyway, you know, if you're just if you know, it's like, again, you know, the example I used of being a medical doctor, you can't do it without training. And by the way, the training doesn't mean it makes you callous and oblivious. Remember I showed the Myers-Briggs there at the end? You begin to look systematically. You also look at what are the blockers in each of that quadrant that prevent us from thinking or the things we can do? Let me give you, I have to give you a concrete example because I do have these real examples that despite all the precautions, kids still die, you know, crossing railroad tracks, you know, every year. And so when I, you know, you look at the Myers-Briggs and I've had groups work on it, the upper left quadrant, which is sensing thinking, how do I get better signals and smart trains that will automatically slow themselves down? The far right, upper right quadrant is how do I look at the whole system and the compensation system, so even if I have good signals on board and somebody doesn't want to listen to it. But listen to the bottom two. The bottom with the whole community. That at a certain time of the day, you organize parents, members of the community, to come together and safely walk the kids across the tracks. And the lower left is what happens in all crises. which is at 9/11, where people come and mourn a single individual, bring pictures or teddy bears or poems of somebody. My point is this. The world is so complex, you need something going on in all four quadrants if you're going to make a dent on any problem. And if you ignore any one of those, you make the problems worse. And yet we don't teach that. We really don't. Some organizations do. That's getting back to the gentleman's question. I mean, I've been looking at this in terms of the education mess. It turns out that not all charter schools are good, but the chartered schools, like the Harlem Children's Zone, that are really outstanding, are doing something in each of the four Myers-Briggs quadrants. They don't call it that. They don't know. So it's not enough just to have good teachers that can motivate, you know, good compensation. You got, and that's why it's so hard, because you've got to do something and you got to integrate it. So I have to get people out of saying, you know, what can you do in an earthquake zone? I'll give you one more thing, that in the center I'm at Berkeley, Bob B., who's a civil environmental engineer, makes a tremendous distinction. There are no natural disasters. All disasters are human caused. There are natural hazards. We don't cause the earthquake, whether we pump water out of the ground. But so we have to look at what can we do with building codes and the like. As a structural engineer, you want to wait around 500 years, come back, all the houses will be on shake tables, we'll write it out into that. Anyway, I didn't mean to spend so long. Let's, yes, sir.
Hi, John O'Connell, World Peace Campaign. About 11 years ago, I think now, J.F. Richard wrote a book called High Noon, 20 Global Issues, 20 Years to Solve Them.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like at 11 years we haven't really solved any of them. But I wonder, from your study, if you see critical core issues at the center of our world crises
That's why I will go back to what I said about the education mess, because I've been in higher education. I've inundated myself, buried myself reading K through 12. And finally, the light came on, because the proponents of charter schools and the enemies, I mean, they're... The title of the book is, proposed book is Parallel Universes. They're like in different worlds. And it finally came clear to me that they were fighting across these cells. And I don't know for sure, but I suspect strongly, because I've looked at the financial crisis, I wish my co-author were here tonight, we see the same thing going on, and I suspect the same thing is true. Now, the circumstances obviously change. Let me just give you an example of Harlem... Children's Zone, Jeffrey Canada, successful charter school in Harlem. One of the things going on in the lower right quadrant, intuitive feeling, if you take a big look at the community, is the following. We know that what goes on outside of school is important than what goes on. So poor kids bring poverty with them inside the school. Unless you get at some of those conditions of poverty, they're not going to be able to learn. So the Harlem Children's Zone has partnered with the organization to bring medical doctors and clinics and to have things working with the parents outside, job training and parenting class. And you begin to see the conditions are very, very stringent, but they're not impossible. But it shows if you really want to make a dent, because you look at all the proposed reforms in education, why they fail, because they haven't been implemented. They've stayed at the verbal level, and the rhetoric and that kind of stuff. So now I don't know whether it's true, say, of all messes. Notice that I'm not just hitting on the political, because that's obviously there. Because I do believe that a lot of the stuff that happens, the innovation happens outside, and then maybe the political game picks it up. But anyway, that's the best answer that I could give you at this point in time. Now, the other part of it, though, is that none of these problems are separable. They all interact. And again, the point of a mess is to say, see, one of the heuristics that comes up in a mess that I've been looking at is look at the most improbable interactions. Those are almost always the source of a crisis. And that means you got to step out of a discipline to do it. You got to think outside the proverbial cliched box, okay? But the point is, there are things we can do. I refuse to give in and say, there's nothing we can do. That's to give up hope, and I don't believe that. Anything else?
Okay, we've come to the point in the program where we have time for only one last question.
You mentioned the athletic departments in particular. I don't know if it was just one university or all, but it seems to me it's sort of a classic case of the universities need the income. They provide the isolation for that athletics because it is the income, but it's supported by the people who give the money. So when you look at that isolation or that complete inability to get to that group, how do you deal with that? Because it's self-fulfilling.
You know, I really wish I knew. I mean, if, you know, the first thing that occurs to me is that, while far from perfect, there is a corporate governance movement afoot trying to reform, you know, how governance is carried on in corporations, and God knows how poor that has been. To say that universities are in need of a new corporate governance is putting it, but you know, that's part of the job, managing all the stakeholders that impact on a university. One of the things that's interesting about a mess, it's far messier than even Acuff and his proponents, you know, his colleagues envision. A mess not only contains all of the mess, it contains all the stakeholders, it contains myths, dreams, fantasies, and it's far messier. And what I'm doing, it's not that I has the magic solution, but here's my point. I hope by starting this kind of conversation inquiry that it starts, you know, eventually, you know, universities will go on, hopefully to the next stage of evolution. Don't, you know, cross your fingers. But I do have hope because the universities were still rooted in a 17th century model with disciplines. I mean, Acuff said it well. Nature is not organized in the same way the universities are. In the real world, we got philosophy and psychology and physics all interacting. It's not put in departments. That's why the design of the current university is dysfunctional. But so is BP. They're all dysfunctional. They don't know it yet. They don't know it. It needs a different design. Well, this my talk is hopefully to spur other people, you know, go beyond what, you know, I've been able to do at this point, which is all that I can do at this point. But I have to say it's it's endlessly fascinating. Why I would never retire, that's just not in my vocabulary. And if I had to point to two disciplines beyond, you know, say engineering, for which I would say it's philosophy and psychoanalysis that are really informative philosophy for the obvious reason. Psychoanalysis because, you know, I think psychoanalysis deals with what's the structure of the psyche. What's the structure of the mind? And, you know, different analysts have different structures, but it's still the structure. And the structures that we don't think about, that's why I showed the slide about the defense mechanisms in organizations. When that happened, I said, it's not just individual denial. It's cultures of denial. So, you know, universities are obviously susceptible to that. And nonetheless, it's, you know, you got to keep hitting the donkey before you get its attention. I don't get you now. I've got to keep raising the ante. That's dangerous, as we know. We don't want to make it worse. I mean, you know, anyway, I think I hope I haven't worn out my welcome with you, and I hope it's I hope it's pushed your thinking, and thank you for coming out and spending your time with me instead of that other crisis guy in D.C., who I do admire.
Okay, I'd like to thank Ian Mitroff.
Thank you.
Okay, our speaker tonight was Ian Mitroff. Our program was Swine, Swans, and Swindlers, Mega Messes and Mega Crises. And with that, I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club. I would like to thank our audience listening at home. And with that, I will close our program tonight of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.